State New York has not a cop, Alice, a detective? Detective. Think of everything you've done, everything you've accomplished. Lots I didn't. Make a wish, Mr. Warlock. That's detective. Detective. Yeah. Come on, Miles. Close your eyes. Make a wish. Well, can I make more than one? Of course you can, my sweet bear. What did you wish for? I wish I could still eat fried food. Wish I didn't have all this cholesterol. Wish I'd punched Robbie Mason in the face back in the fourth grade. Wish restaurants didn't put fruit in salads. Disgusting. Wish I didn't lose Papa's army tags in the ocean that year we went to Florida for vacation. Wish I'd buried him with Mom's crucifix, like he'd asked. I wish I hadn't have been so selfish. Wish I didn't have bunions so bad. My big toes look like they're, well, they have smaller toes growing on them. Wish we had one more kid, Alice. Wish I'd made lieutenant. Had more resources at my disposal to, well, to have helped more. To have done more. Wish I could forget some things and remember others. Wish that someday they'd find her, someday soon. Wish I had.
3. The Decade of Dawning by Donald Ellis. Dedicated to the life of Michael Parker. A year goes by. 2. 5. Every unanswered season spins an ocean of apparitions inside you. Ghosts crash like phantom waves, breaking your mind, a limp swimmer who floats, landless. A new spring sets in, unsettling your senses, piercing the mud with needled stems, shoving life and its living in your face, making your heart glitter black as a moon's thought. Another year goes by. 2. 5. Summer burns spring's hair, sears its scalp, bloodies its bruising, blossoms a fresh, boiling despair within you. You squint your eyes at every female figure. Your pulse lurches, heaving nervous, questions at your skin. Is that her? Another year goes by. 2. 5. Summer cripples into the rippling qualms of fall. You begin to forget. All the dying leaves of your past plunge to earth like a star's debris. There's a cooling, a calming. Your mouth remembers to brush its teeth, not the murky memory of its battery. Pain grows distant, but never separate. Another year goes by. 2. 5. Winter overthrows autumn, and your body becomes an avalanche of damaged ice, waiting for some crueler, crooked sun. Every clock's a coffin tick you've grieved. Your time goes on, but your hands cannot. If you've learned anything, it's that snow can't be trusted. One day your daughter's angels, the next a predator's footprints. You splinter, wonder if they'll ever catch her. See a shadow moving in the river. Winter. Is that her? 8. 1.
Good afternoon. I'm Donald Ellis, and you're listening to The Ellis Show, America's number one afternoon radio program here on Sirius XM Radio. Thanks to all of you, our listeners and heroes. Because of listeners like you, we've been able to identify and catch predators on the run for almost a decade, as well as to help those who've called in and shared their most difficult and painful stories to heal. I'm honored to say that over the past 8 years, we've been able to help authorities apprehend over 460 individuals accused of violent sexual crimes. And I've been merely the conduit for those apprehensions, ladies and gentlemen, but you have done the truly hard work. You've been the eyes and ears in our country, paying attention and turning in those who wish to harm others. I've said it from day one of this show, and I'll say it again. American citizens make the difference. Not me, not investigators, not state attorneys, not prosecutors, not bureaucrats, not legislators. You, the people, you are the ones with the power. You are the ones who know your communities, know when something doesn't seem right. I believe with all my heart that if someone had been there that night, the night of my attack, a witness, my assault would never have happened. Or if it did, my attacker would have at least been caught. But they never caught her, did they? No, they didn't. They never even identified her. She's still out there, a supreme predator, dormant for now. And speaking of that awful night, I'd like to take a moment to tell you, this is a very big day for me and my family. Very big day. And because of that, this will be a very special program for listeners, I hope. It was exactly 10 years ago today, on March 2nd in 2016, that I was violently assaulted and left for, I don't know, dead behind a dumpster, exactly to the day. For a very long time, I could not speak about this experience. I could not speak at all. I lived in a state of death, a limbo between the past of who I was and the future of what I'd become. I tried to go back to teaching, tried to go back home, back to my life, my wife and kids, back to normal. But my world was, it was forever gone. It felt like a sun in a perpetual state of setting. It's the only way I can describe it to you, how things felt, an unending sense of twilight. Everything I did, everything I said, everything I saw was dusk. My whole life had turned into impending nightfall. My existence was just caught light, suspended in semi-darkness. I quit teaching at the recommendation of my doctor and my wife. She took care of me for years after that until I could get back on my feet, until I could, at the very least, learn how to live in that purgatory of shades, not dead, but not dead either. And as if the pain of what had been done to me wasn't enough, as if the shame and the guilt and the scraps of my broken body weren't constant reminders, my wife and I received hateful letters, death threats even, from people all across the country for months. I had asked for it, they wrote. I was a piece of shit. I was a deadbeat, a sinner, a prick, a pussy, weak, a pansy, a wimp, candy ass, a faggot, a bitch, a Mary, a limp dick. They said I made men look bad, or that my wife should divorce me, or that I should probably give my kids up for adoption, or better yet, just kill myself so my son wouldn't have to grow up knowing his father was a cockless coward. That's a direct quote. We had to move to another city. My children had to leave their schools. The bullying, it was a cruelty I would not wish on anyone. It was a cruelty I'll never forget. It ripped me apart, you know? It ripped me apart. Eventually, I found a sense of living. I found a way to live. The more I was able to talk about what happened, to put into words the actions of that woman, the more I found a small amount of peace. Because of the national attention my case received, I suddenly found myself with an audience and in a position to speak to that audience about the things that had mattered most. And what matters are the voiceless. You know what murder, assault, robbery, false imprisonment, kidnapping, sexual assault all have in common? They are all considered violent crimes. But only one of those is a deeply intimate crime. Only one places blame on the victims. Did you know that 1 in 16 men in America have been raped? And those are just the ones who have reported it. You know that basketball team you play on after work? You know the birthday party you went to last night? You know that board meeting you had this morning? You know that movie theater you were in last week or that cafeteria you're in right now? Listening to me talk into your headphones, there is almost 100% chance that at least one person in that room, one person in that meeting or theater has been sexually assaulted in their lifetime. Approximately 68% of all sexual assaults go unreported, according to RAINN. R-A-I-N-N. Sexual assault is the single least reported violent crime. And when it is reported, the victims are blamed and shamed and not believed or silenced, punished, or their attackers are never prosecuted at all. Do you know how many backlogged rape kits are just sitting on police station shelves in America waiting to be tested? Rape kits filled with evidence. 10,000 kits in Cleveland. Yeah. 4,000 in Illinois. 11,000 in Detroit alone. 20,000 in the state of Texas. Over 70,000 in total that we know of. Well, only 6 states have laws requiring agencies to send in these kits to crime labs to be tested. 6 states. So why should victims come forward? When they see statistics like this, when they see that they aren't a priority, when they see that finding and prosecuting a sexual predator is not on any law enforcement officer's to-do list. And this is why I speak, ladies and gentlemen, why I fight, why the work we do here matters. We have something very special for you today. It fills me with a lot of hope and joy and, of course, anxiety. We have a very special guest with us on the program today, Jamar Sands. His name might sound familiar to you. Jamar, if you recall, was also a victim of MOD almost a decade ago. He and I have become acquaintances over the years, but this will be our first time speaking together publicly. It's important for both of us to keep the story alive. As long as that woman is out there, we will not give up. So stick around. We'll be right back after this break.
Two. No one wants to hear about the beginning. They want to hear about the middle or the end. And while I can't tell you what the end looks like just yet, I can tell you about the middle. My sister Jen was pounding on the window, screaming my name. "Jamar, open the fucking door," she said. I couldn't open the door because I couldn't stand up. One of the many bummers of living in a smaller town is that everyone knows everyone. So, of course, the chick I bought razors from at the grocery store was Courtney, who had been roommates with Jen at the College of St. Rose. "Open the fucking door now or I'll break the goddamn glass," she yelled. Let me back up for a second, to the beginning of the middle. I feel like I can't justify the end of the middle, and certainly not the beginning of the end, unless I tell you about the beginning of the middle first. It had been exactly 2 weeks since the police had come and gone. The FBI dude had come and gone. My family had come, and I'd wished they'd gone. I was sitting alone in my kitchen with a peeled orange on my plate. "Eat, dude, eat." But this orange looked different than other oranges, than other foods entirely. All the white strands hung off it, like the pubic hairs of an albino or something. An albino woman. Woman. The word tasted abandoned, and the texture of that orange, when I touched it, it was so human and rough. It's what I imagine we feel like, right beneath our skin. Rough. Not soft at all. Everything right beneath the skin has such a soft name, you know? Gland, fat, nerve, soft tissues. But I'll bet the underneath isn't all that soft. Like, not just bones, but also cartilage and muscle and tendon. We're not soft inside. I think people confuse the interior body's sliminess for softness. My palms were sweating. I couldn't really feel my feet. That fucking orange man just sitting there in front of me, exposed, skinless. I could feel his exposedness, its pulpy insides. It would be so easy to touch it. I could stick my thumbs in through its stomach and rip it wide open if I wanted to. So I did. The sound of it coming apart, its pieces separating like a sheet of paper ripping or a heavy exhalation was enough to make me sick. All its scattered pieces of peel ripped from its body on the plate. I remember all my scattered clothes ripped from my body on the floor. She moved on me, that bitch. The memory was so strong. I just passed out right there. I just passed out right there on the floor. For weeks, I couldn't eat anything with a peel. I told no one about this. People eating bananas in public made me nauseous. Pretty soon, anything at all that needed to be peeled was just sickening. Tamales, shrimp, garbanzo beans, some types of lettuce. The minute I thought about having to remove some kind of layer, some kind of skin off of food, I was done. I was in a public restroom gagging or in my car trying to calm the hell down. I needed to fix this problem I was having with food, I told myself. It dawned on me that I could just stop eating those things. I completely had the right to do that without questioning myself or losing my shit every time my mom offered me some sad-ass scalped avocado. I could just say no. The mind is the master and the body is the servant. That's Kettlebells 101. So I made the conscious decision to discipline my eating in the way I discipline my training, mind over matter. Once I gave myself that permission, the nausea, the anxiety, the anger of a feeling out of control just went away. Everything was so much clearer. My protein shakes didn't really need to have a banana in them, or any fruit for that matter. Pretty much every fruit has a peel on it of some kind. And almond milk had to go, because almonds also have a kind of skin. And of course, by this same logic, things like spinach had to go. Spinach is from a flowering plant, and that's a lot of different kinds of skins, when you think about it. Petals, leaves, all of that had to go. Plus, I'd read somewhere that scientists had recently figured out how to transform spinach into human heart tissue, tissue capable of beating. I wasn't going to eat that. No fucking way was I going to eat that. I started investigating other plants as well, other types of greens, kale, for example. Once I started doing my research, I couldn't believe what I found. Kale is actually part of the cabbage family, and cabbage sprouts these beautiful yellow and white flowers, and cabbage leaves protect their inflorescence like, you guessed it, like a kind of skin. So kale was out. Cabbage was definitely out. Parsley, romaine, red leaf, mustard greens, arugula, endive, chard, all of it. Anything leafed. How could anyone in their right mind eat something that once had leaves, I thought? Leaves are a part of a vascular system that nourishes a plant or flower, either by sheltering its insides or by absorbing sunlight and oxygen and stuff. Skin. Everywhere I looked, I saw skin. What edible substance didn't have a skin, I wondered. It goes without saying that all meats and fish were completely out. Nuts were out. Corn had husks. Peas had pods. Cheese had rinds. Oysters had shells. Skim milk sounds like skinned. The next few months were filled with a fresh happiness and sense of purpose, the kind I'd never felt before. By cleaning out my body, I was cleaning out the trauma I'd experienced. All thoughts of what happened to me had been replaced with a newfound understanding of the world and my place in it. I couldn't believe the shit I'd been putting into my body, the cruelty. Everyone was so happy with how quickly I bounced back, even though they didn't really know why or how. They never asked. But if they had, I would have said, success is the sum of small efforts repeated day in and day out. I returned to kettlebell training and maintained my healthy way of eating. I made some exceptions for things like condiments. Mustard was actually a fantastic food for me to eat. Yes, a mustard plant has leaves and flowers, but the seed itself doesn't need to be peeled, you see? So that was totally fine. Now ketchup, on the other hand, ketchup comes from tomatoes, and tomatoes most definitely have skin on them. So I allowed myself some small exceptions. For lunch, I could have as many tablespoons of mustard as I wanted. But I could only have 1 teaspoon of ketchup per day. And cottage cheese was all right to eat, believe it or not, though I kept my portions very small just in case. Just in case some newfound information about rennet or curds was discovered. Cactus was a good one, too. Cactus have flowers, but no leaves. So you see, I made some exceptions here and there. I wasn't totally rigid. And bread was safe, although I didn't want to eat too much of it. A typical lunch would look like this. Half a cup of cottage cheese, half a slice of bread, 3 tablespoons of mustard, and 1 teaspoon of ketchup, which I put directly into my mouth only after the SAS foods have been swallowed, so as not to contaminate them with ketchup. SAS foods are what I called skinless and safe foods. Just a quick way for me to identify them. I began to see a major change in my body, in a good way, I thought. I was losing all my body fat and becoming toned. I used to be ripped, but I didn't want to be ripped anymore. I wanted to be toned. I wanted to be lean and strong. My sister grew extremely suspicious. She would leave work early and come surprise me in my apartment with my favorite takeout. What used to be my favorite takeout. But my sister knows I've always hated surprises. I would tell her I already ate. I'm worried about you, she'd say. She handed me a pamphlet she picked up, some therapy group for guys in town, specializing in trauma and PTSD. I thanked her and I said I would check it out. I was never going to do that. No fucking way, man. And looking back now on my sis, she knew I wasn't going to either. So she kept an eye on me, checked in daily. Jen was my older sister by almost 6 years, and she had always been super independent. She was the cool punk rock girl in school who all my friends drooled over. She had thick, black, curly hair and green eyes. Green eyes came from my mom's side of the family, the hair from my dad's. Because we're mixed, Haitian on my father's and Irish on my mother's, Jen had this look about her that some dicks would call exotic. I fucking hated that growing up. When guys called her that. Call my sister exotic again, motherfucker. I'll break your mouth. Jen could hold her own, though. She didn't need me to be some thick-headed little bro jock for her. I tried, but it was always the other way around. Jen was always the one looking out for me. Always. I gave in to Jen's surprise takeout dinners after I ran out of excuses and was afraid she'd tell Mom or something. But not without self-imposed consequences. After she'd leave, I'd get an overwhelming sense of dread. A sick feeling in my entire body. It was like I had poisoned it by eating all that trash. I knew I had to get it out of me, but I hated throwing up. I really hated that. So I went into the bathroom and got a razor out. I was sweating and I couldn't see very well. I made a small cut in my stomach. Just a small one. The second I saw blood come out, I became calm. I could feel the poison coming out of me. I could almost feel it leaving me. I cried. It was the first time I had felt relief in a long time. This became the perfect solution to my dinners with my sister. It also allowed me to start eating with friends again, to start going out again. I could eat SAS as I normally did. But if I was forced to eat non-SAS food, like if someone ordered something for the table or whatever and I didn't want things to be awkward, I could have a couple of bites of that non-SAS food and just release the poison from my stomach later. These weren't deep cuts I was making in my stomach. They were just small ones, enough to let the contamination out, but not to, like, send me to the hospital or anything. My favorite Dwayne Johnson quote about training is, "It's you versus you." Meaning, you're the only thing standing in your own way. You're the only thing you're up against. So I got even stricter with my SAS diet when I wasn't out with friends or family. When I didn't have to put on a show for them. I cut out cottage cheese and a few other SAS items I used to be allowed to eat. I drank tons of water, more than I'd ever drank before. Water was very safe. I felt that if I didn't keep the poison out of me, she could appear. If I stopped caring about my health and what I put into my body, she could appear. If I ate too much, she could appear. If I stopped working out, she could appear. If I had less than the required amount of water per day, she could appear. She could appear. She could appear. She would appear. Then one day, she appeared. I hadn't eaten in 2 days, only water and mustard. I was doing great, I thought. Me versus me, and I was winning. In the mornings, I would get up and do 100 crunches, no matter how much a fresh, open cut on my stomach hurt. In the mirror, the little scars swam across my ribs, and my ribs swam across whatever was left underneath, and I felt safe. I was disappearing here in this world, which in some way meant I was reappearing somewhere else. I was whole somewhere else. I was free somewhere else. That thought was comforting. The parallel me had never been raped, had never been touched, had never been so obscenely violated. The parallel me had no restrictions, still enjoyed sunlight. The parallel me had a future that couldn't be darkened by his past. I went to my computer to do some work. I opened my old OKCupid account and looked at the list of screen names and saw hers there, offline. This is something I did once in a while. Checked in to see if she was, you know, around. I never told anyone, though. I go online and just stare. Stare at that screen name. Maud. Maud. It was always offline. But there she was. Regardless, there she was, so close, as if on the other side of a door, waiting for me. She never knocked that night we met. She had told me in our chat that she would be there at midnight on the dot, and just open the door exactly at 12 a.m., leave all your lights off, she said, let's play. The apartment building light was bright behind her when I opened the door. There was a silhouette of a mask, a wolf mask. She was carrying a plastic bag. I thought I could see her nails. They were either nails or bones. She came in faster than a wind and shut the door behind her. We were in the darkness from the moment she entered. She put her finger against my mouth, no talking. We didn't speak. I had been told not to speak. We ate in silence. She opened a bottle of liquor in silence. She placed my hand on the stereo in silence. We danced to classic rock in silence. She took me to the bathroom. She drew a bath. She washed me. She put my hand on her thigh. She bit me. In the dark. The silence. Her mouth was the softest I'd ever felt. But her face felt like some kind of coarse crust, like bridge iron, like it had a thick coat on it. A second skin. Skin. Can we turn on the lights? I want to see you. You don't want to see me, Wolf. You want to feel me. You want to feel me, don't you? Her voice wasn't even in the room. Her voice was coming from inside me. Her hands held my wrist down. She started to hum. The world vibrated. Her hands were strong and cold, and they held me against the couch with ease. "Just let me, Wolf. Let me do it." "No, hang on. I want the lights on. Please don't." But she kept going. And I let her. I let her. My sister Jen was pounding on the window, screaming my name. "Jamar, open the fucking door," she said. I couldn't open the fucking door because I couldn't stand up. I had opened my stomach with a razor blade from as far around the back to the front of my body as I could possibly reach and cut. I had peeled myself open, like an orange. Not deep, but deep enough to get the poison out. To get her voice out. Just hours before, I had read that she raped another man. His name was Sebastian. There were no details, but I didn't need the details. I knew whatever she had done it dreadfully. I imagined the worst. She stuck objects inside him and made him guess. She poured animal urine in his mouth and made him guess. She wouldn't let him look at her. She laughed and called him a crybaby. She grunted as she came, like some dying pig. She left, as if she'd only come by to borrow some salt. As if she hadn't just taken his life away and left him barely lived. I was ready to die as my sister's fist came smashing through the glass.
3.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Donald. My name's Nathan, calling from Oklahoma. Nathan, without a last name, if that's okay.
Hi, Nathan. Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
It's not really a question, really. I just want to thank you and that fellow Jamar you just had on the program. It gave me hope. Hearing him talk about his recovery, about how his sister found him there like that, you know, almost dead like that on his couch. Split open. I mean, praise be, the part after she got him to the hospital in time and saved his life, and how she got him to go to that therapy place where he befriended that other guy, the guy named after a fruit. It's kind of a good thing. It's a good thing to have a happy ending like that. It's a beautiful thing. Brought tears to my eyes. And it is a choice, you know, living. Like that young man said, just like dying can be a choice. And I really could relate to that thing he said about living with the anger and all that, that it's okay not to accept what happened, to find no resolve, but still live a parallel happy life, a life adjacent to the things you cannot forgive. I really liked that. That spoke to me.
Indeed, Nathan. It is a choice. Indeed. Thank you for calling us today. Go ahead, next caller. You're live on the Ellis Show.
Nancy, calling from San Francisco, California.
Hi, Nancy. How's the fog treating you today?
Colder than a witch's tit, as they say, Don. Colder than a witch's tit. Anyway, listen, wow, Donald, I can't believe I'm actually on the air with you right now. I'm a big fan and have been listening to your show for 5 years now. And though I've never called, I just had to call today to tell you how wonderful this interview was. Wow, how powerful. I was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge in horrible traffic when Mr. Sands talked about his wedding and Mr. O'Sullivan being his best man. I mean, yeah, I was sitting there in traffic, and the sun was going down like it always does here beyond the bridge, and I just burst into tears. You know, it got me thinking, Mr. Ellis, it got me thinking really hard.
Tell me, Nancy, about what?
Well, I have 3 boys who are all grown up now, all very successful, might I add, proud mama over here, but hearing Mr. Sands just made me really think of how I contribute in both the negative and positive sense of the word. I realize more than ever we need to keep fighting and protecting our kids, not just from predators, but also from a society and a culture that feels kind of predatory, you know? I mean, that lady did the crimes, but we publicized it. We capitalized on it. We exploited it for ratings or whatever, for stories or our memes and GIFs and tweeting and all that. We jump on the train. We show their pictures on live TV. We make clever hashtags. We find ways to, like, absolve ourselves from responsibility or say we've helped out with a retweet or something. We've helped because we've mentioned an injustice in passing to our neighbor, and we both got to shake our heads. We've helped because we painted a sign. Like I look at my boys and I think, what if this had happened to them? Or worse, what if any of them had done this to someone? And it made me realize that my job as a mother is never done. I must always teach them how to treat women, even as grown men. That is how I can contribute. This is how I can really help.
This is such a great point, Nancy, and I believe it's on all of us to think this way, to be introspective this way and ask ourselves the hardest questions we've ever had to ask. Thanks for calling in. Caller, you're on the air. This is Donald.
Hey, Donald. My name is Eric from Arizona, born and raised.
Hey, Eric from Arizona. Oh, what's your question for us today?
Well, first, thank you so much for having Mr. Sands on your program today. I was laughing and also crying when he told the story about Mr. O'Sullivan giving that poor toast at his wedding and bombing with his bad cake joke.
Yeah, that got me good too, Eric.
Yeah, I bet, buddy. The crying part came for me when Mr. Sands talked about his son, naming his son Pear last year after Mr. O'Sullivan passed away from cancer. I wanted to say, as a survivor of suicide myself, as a person who made it through two attempts, who still sometimes wonders, who sometimes just wonders if it would have been better, you know, to have followed through. I wanted to say that Mr. Sands' perspective on life and cheer despite all that made me feel less alone. And I do hope Mr. Sands goes through with that tree planting ceremony to honor his friend. I like that a lot.
Me too, Eric. I never met Pear, but talked to him once over the phone many years ago. I tried to get him to come out and protest with us, but I got the sense he wasn't ready for that. You know, even on the short phone call, I could tell he was very funny and very kind. Whether he believes it or not, he'll be missed by many. So many. Hi there, caller. This is Donald.
My man, Donald.
Hey, my man. Who's my man here?
Ronnie Mann from Pittsburgh.
Oh, Jesus. Ronnie, why didn't I recognize your voice?
Got a little cold, man. Makes me sound like a real baritone.
I'll say. Thought I was talking to Barry White's grandfather for a second.
Well, I could be. Let me tell you, I'm older than cloth wiring, brother. Let me tell you.
That is old, Ronnie. Very old.
Listen, D, what a show, man. What a show. I hope you have that brother on again, man. I'm sure you're getting a million calls right now, man. But let me just say quickly that I've worked at a crisis center for almost a decade now, and I can tell you how important this kind of work is, man, even if you never share it publicly, like my man Jamar just did. Even if you never make a thing out of it publicly, it's so important to do the work and take care of yourself. I hope folks come out of the woodwork today because of Jamar's story. I hope they come out if they've been sexually assaulted or experienced anything that made them feel they need to hide or they can't speak. They can go to rain.org and get lots of information on the steps they can take for self-care.
Yeah, self-care is the motto. I say it and I practice it all day, every day.
Yeah, man, the bottom line, like I always tell my patients, man, there are many things in this world that are not on your side, especially after being raped. The law is not on your side. Public perception is not on your side. Sometimes your own body isn't even on your side. But I'm on your side, man. I'm on your side, and clinics are on your side. To help you do you. To heal what you can and say fuck all to the rest. Shit, sorry, can't say fuck on the air. Shit, I just said shit too, man. Fuck.
Damn it, Ronnie. Last time you called in, I told you I wasn't going to cry. The next time you called, but now I can feel the tears coming.
I always get you, man. I got your number, man.
That you do, friend. You've been listening
to you for almost 10 years, damn straight I have, D, and I'm looking forward to that book you promised you'd write one day. You and your novel, man, I hope you get back into that glorious writing of yours again. It's what you were born to do, brother.
Thanks, Ronnie. Means a lot. All right, next caller, you are on the air.
Hi. Hey, my name's Ezra Fisher. I'm calling because, I'm calling from Somerset State Correctional. I'm an inmate here, so thank you for taking this call. I've been here for 2 years on charges on robbery and aggravated assault and some other things. And I'm calling because thank you, Mr. Ellis, for your show, for everything you do. I listen to your show here when I get the chance. A few months ago, I read the op-ed you wrote in the Prospect Times, the one where you gave us like a good spell to cast on ourselves. And I felt like you were speaking directly to me, Mr. Ellis. I did. And like, I know we never met before, but I guess today I wanted to tell you something. I'm ready to tell you something that I was assaulted by her, but I never told no one. I never told, and I probably should have, you know. I should have, because I saw her, Mr. Ellis. I saw her face.
Part 9. To Whom It May Concern. I looked up last will and testament online last night to find examples of how to write one. I found a few various forms and also a porn movie about a guy named Will and a guy named Testament, and you get the idea. Anyway, my name is Per O'Sullivan. I'm dying of cancer. But you already know that because you're the person who will allocate my nonsense after I'm gone. I don't have much, but what I do have matters to me, so what the hell? Maybe it will matter to someone else as well. Okay, here we go. To my ex-wife, Patricia Lorenzo, I give my collection of 45s, LPs, CDs, and vinyl. She hated me, but she loved my record collection. X's Los Angeles, Rare REM, the Quadrophenia soundtrack. She especially loved my comedy vinyl for some reason. Richard Pryor, Dick Gregory, David Cross, Lenny Bruce, Joan Rivers, Hicks, of course. Give them all to her. She deserves them. To Bobby M. Johnson from Group, I give my Forest Green 95 Toyota Camry. It is the ugliest piece of shit ever created and still the most reliable. Just like you, Bobby. To my mother, Pearl Olympia O'Sullivan, I am sorry you outlived your only son. This should happen to no mother ever. I am sorry I never made much of myself or gave you grandkids or could buy you a house. Please know that despite everything that happened in my life, I loved you so much and I was happy. At the end of it all, I went happy. Jesus, this is starting to sound like a suicide note. Okay, so to Pearl, I give my collector's items, which include my collection of bobbleheads, comics, and my American silver quarter from 1970. Ma, don't spend the quarter, okay? Please tell this to my mother. The quarter is extremely valuable due to a misprint, and you can get good money for it. Those idiots in the Treasury were so cheap, they decided to use Canadian quarters from 1941 and print over them. So if you look closely at the backside of the 70 quarter, where the American Eagle is, you'll see a 41 ever so slightly coming through. Sell all these things, Ma, except the quarter, then I can say I bought you a home. To the Upper Valley Haven Social Services Organization in Vermont, I give all my furniture, clothing, and kitchen items, except for one thing, which is listed below. To Pamela from Group, who made the best waffles I ever had, thank you for your kindness over the years and for making a bunch of rejects feel like kings. To Pamela, I give all my potted plants and flowers, including my teal sweet bay magnolias. Side note, Pam, if for some reason I'm not found for a few days, my body and all those magnolias have died, please do not throw them away. It is my wish to be cremated with them. Speaking of which, it is my wish to be cremated. Please place my remains in a Coca-Cola cup and leave me under a bleacher at Fenway Park during the next World Series. I mean it. Don't take me out after the game. Leave me there and just let me be swept away with the empty beer bottles and hot dog wrappers. That trash always made me so happy. Made me feel like I was in a place where people were really living. To my neighbor, Allison Beckett, I give my house, the only property I have ever owned. It is small and worth nothing, I know, but it's my intent that it be turned into a library slash museum for artifacts, photographs, letters, and any memories from our community pertaining to Maggie the Maple Tree. This is the greatest apology I have to offer, Mrs. Beckett. You might be wondering why I'm apologizing, but let's just leave it at this offering. To Jamar Sands, my friend, who is expecting his first kid, a kid I hope to get to meet before I leave this clogged artery of an earth, I give all my journals, all of them. It is my hope that you will find some funny bedtime reading in there for your little guy or girl, whatever she or he will be named. I miss you already, man, and I'm not even dead yet. I miss you. Love you, bud. Last and definitely least to the woman known as Maud, if they ever find her, please send my broom's handle to her in prison with a note saying, I'm waiting for you here in hell, Maud. I've saved you a cot right next to me for eternity. Sincereless, Per Ronald O'Sullivan.
One. I wasn't planning on ending up in here at 20 years old. None of us ever are. I always gotta say that out loud to people because I feel like they see me, my record, and they see these tattoos, and they think, yeah, he was a bad kid. But I was never a bad kid. Ever. I was into cars. Model cars. I had a collection of everything from Volkswagens to Ferraris. I grew up in Warren, Pennsylvania. Lived in nice neighborhood. Middle class. White parents. With some money. Not a lot, but, you know, enough. Just happy kid. Outgoing kid and all that. I was gonna grow up and sell cars, vintage ones. I was gonna take shop. I was gonna know a car inside and out. That's the kind of kid I was. I had plans. Lots of friends, you know. My best friend's name was Arthur Milwaukee, like the city. Man, I haven't seen Arthur in a long time. Arthur was a redheaded retard. I don't mean a retarded retard. He was just a retard. You know what I mean. A dumbo who got in trouble for bringing whoopee cushions to class like we lived in the 1950s or some shit. Arthur and I walked home from school together every day. He called me Rezzy instead of Ezra, so that was my nickname, Rezzy. And we loved playing Final Fantasy and basketball. We didn't know a damn thing about basketball, though, or how to play it. We'd get big glasses of milk from the fridge and take our shirts off and take turns running around in circles like dying chickens and then throw the ball into the hoop. We didn't mind not knowing the rules. We made up our own most of the time. Arthur and I always had Saturday sleepovers. Me at his or him at mine. Arthur and Ezra. That was us. The car kid and the retard. One New Year's Eve, Arthur's parents were having a party. They had some weird friends over, you know, wearing lots of turquoise and shit. East Coast hippies. It wasn't a big party, but enough for us to stay up and go unnoticed past midnight. I went to the bathroom to go pee, but the door was locked, so I used the one in Arthur's parents' bedroom instead. That one was always strictly off-limits, but I really had to go. I was in the middle of peeing when I heard the door open and close. Before I could even turn around, there was someone there, behind me. And they put their hands on me, she took me by my, she held it and took my hands off it as I was going. She held it like that from behind me. She asked me what my name was, but I couldn't speak. She asked again. I told her Ezra. She said it was nice to meet me and that I could call her anything I wanted to. But I didn't want to call her anything. I wanted her to let go of me. But she asked me if I liked girls. I said, I guess. She asked me if I liked to play games with girls. I said, I didn't know. She asked if she could play with me. She asked if I liked it, her holding me like that. She asked if I wanted her to pull on it gently. I've never said this to someone out loud. I'll just tell you that she made me have sex with her, okay? She told me I had to or she was going to hurt my mom and dad. She told me I could never tell anyone because she'd come back and hurt me and hurt my family. So she made me promise. And she told me I could turn around and look at her, but then I had to go climb on the bed and not say a word. I had to be quiet or else I'd get in trouble. She said if my friend's parents found out what I was doing in their bedroom, they'd be really angry with me. Turn around, she said. And I was crying and shaking. Don't cry, she said. I'm not going to hurt you. I just want us to have fun. I'll be very gentle. I didn't want to, I said. Come on, she said. Turn around and look at me. So I turned around. She was just a normal woman. She had brown hair and brown eyes. She wasn't pretty. She wasn't ugly. She wasn't really old, but she wasn't young either. She was just a normal woman. Do you know who I am? She asked me. I told her no. Good, she said. After she did what she did, she told me to count very slowly to whatever age I was and not move until I was done counting, and she left. I did the count twice because I was so scared it wasn't enough time. It would have only been a count to 10. I was only 10 years old. She hadn't lied when she said she wasn't going to hurt me. She didn't. She was gentle. I said nothing. I think I held my breath the entire time. I just stared up at the ceiling. There was nowhere else to look. I remember feeling like if I didn't move, if I just stared at the same spot on the ceiling, that I wasn't even there in the room, that I had disappeared. I could see where Arthur's parents had water damage stains above us, big brown circles mapped across the ceiling. I traced the lines. Imagine there were different things each time, a race car track, a dying snail. I left the room and went downstairs. She was nowhere. Everyone was drunk and laughing. Arthur was asleep on the sofa. I was fucking mad. He should have come looking for me. Why didn't he come for me? That night I had a nightmare. I have it often. I've had it so many times I know it by heart now. I can see it backward and forward. It's part of my reality. Even here in jail, that dream is more real than prison. In the dream, we are back in that bathroom. I turn toward her. Her face has every face in it. It's everyone I've ever known or seen or imagined combined into one monstered offering. And her hair is everywhere. It's all over the rooms, running down into the drains of the sink and bathtub, and even overflowing out the window in the other room. It covers houses next door and mountains in the distance. It's alive. Her hair. And she's so tall. Her shoulders touch the roof. Her head is small and unnatural and bobs across the ceiling looking down at me. Her eyes move rapidly on her face like caught flies trapped under glass. And her chin is bigger than the width of her body and has no skin on it, like some kind of whale's mouth. She has no lips, but kind of hole in the middle where plant-like vines grow from her mouth and hang down. But they aren't real plants. They're some kind of flesh. Strings of flesh. Flesh vines. Thick, mossy nerve endings, and at the ends of those vines are flowers. Beautiful flowers, covered in drool. Drool dripped from her mouth, and when she talks, the vines jiggle like she's an earthquake rattling a potted plant or something. She tells me to get in bed, and I walk through a giant, unseen spiderweb that spreads across my face. And the spider's already inside me, I think. It's already inside. And then I wake up. I went back home and said nothing to my parents the next day. Couldn't go to the bathroom by myself anymore, but I said nothing about why. I couldn't be alone, ever, for any reason. I didn't sleep over at Arthur's anymore. The more hurt he'd get, the angrier I'd get. I felt it was kind of his fault. But I stopped hanging out with him altogether. Once he asked me why I was so mad all the time, so I punched him. It felt good to do that, to punch something. The school counselor asked me why I did it. My parents asked me why I did it. Arthur asked me why I did it, but I never told them. I made a promise to her that I would never tell. I traded out Rezzy for a new nickname, Easy, short for Ezra. I made new friends. My best one was a fat, short kid named Marley, who we called Fat Short Kid. Fat Short Kid had a dad who smoked, so he'd steal cigarettes for us. First cigarettes a little, then on to the better stuff. Stuff his older cousin could get for us. It helped me feel blank. Helped me forget stuff for a little while. By 12, I was already a different person. I mean, I was a different person the minute I walked out of that bedroom that night, but by 12, I was even more different. I cut school all the time. Got into a couple more fights, got suspended. My mother was a mess. By the time I was 14, I was a local fuck-up. I was that kid, the kid all the neighbors feared. I was a bad seed waiting to sprout. My pops barely talked to me, and I thought, good, fuck you anyway. You weren't there for me. You did nothing. Fat Short Kid and me started selling instead of just smoking. At first it was weed, and then we moved on, moved up, and all that. Fat Short Kid's parents had enough and sent him to boarding school. I remember his dumpy face with that mole near his lip waving goodbye to me from his mom's truck as they left school forever. I never saw Fatty again. Felt like anyone I cared about was taken away from me or just didn't care to stay. Jim Beam was the only friend I had left. Whatever was in whoever's liquor cabinet. I was getting drunk in my bedroom alone one night. I think I was 16 by then. My mom would do searches of my room looking for shit, but she never thought to check my old model car collection. The hoods could pop open on some of those joints, so I stashed my shit in there. And any liquor I'd put in a flask inside my homework binder. Anyway, I was getting drunk this one night alone and decided to sneak out. I ran down the street looking into the windows of the other houses. Thought about going into one. Fuck it, I thought. I'll just try the doorknob and see. And of course it was unlocked. Everyone kept doors unlocked in my old hood. So I snuck in and looked around. And everyone was sleeping. It's a crazy feeling, like, of power. That I could do anything I wanted. If I wanted to. But all I did was grab a vase and run out as fast as I could. The dream. The long hair in the drain. The shrunken fly eyes. The swollen face with the fish teeth. The hands made out of wood. The fingernails with fur on them. The protruding spine that ran down her back and all the way down her legs. Her feet. Her feet like big men's feet. And a spider sitting in my lungs, building a web. I started getting better at stealing things. First jewelry and electronics.